Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, Gil Hodges is a Hall of Famer. I am proud to say that as we come at you live on the Mets Theme Podcast. That was our fellow Mets fan, Adam Spiegel, with the 86 theme that he has given to us. And we're so thankful that he did, and I always want to give a shout-out to him for that. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a lovely evening here on the Mets Theme Podcast. Thank you for joining us. If this is your first time, like and subscribe. Even if it isn't your first time, make sure anywhere you listen to podcasts to like and subscribe and continue to listen. We're so happy to have our featured guests on. But before we bring them on, let me say hello to Mike Lacolan in Brooklyn, as always. Are you shouting in the streets of Bensonhurst right now?
Not for nothing, but we shared a moment before the show earlier. We established that we both cried like babies upon learning about his induction into the Hall of Fame. I was eating dinner. I started to cry. My wife started to cry because I started to cry. And then you and I texted, and you said you were crying. And then we called each other, and we were crying. So happy day. Happy day in Brooklyn. Happy day for the Hodges family. I'm so happy for Joan, Irene, Gil Jr. So happy that, you know, they have this day to celebrate, finally.
It really is, finally. As I said on another podcast, we do 70-odd years in the making. And we're going to get right into it with the Till Mets Do Us Part partners in crime, John Saponaro and Matt Ibanez. And I'll start with you, John. I saw you out at the Queens Baseball Convention. You and I weren't able to meet in person, but thank you for joining us on the Metsian Podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and thank you for some of the kind stuff that you said to me online about my hosting of the QBC. I really appreciate it. It's an awesome event, and one that for me was a long time in the making. I wanted to come out to a QBC and work with those guys for a while, but my schedule wouldn't allow it, so I'm really happy to have done that, and I'm really happy to be on the show now.
And let's go over to your partner, Matt Ibanez. Matt, thank you for joining us tonight.
Guys, I really appreciate you having us on, and obviously I don't have the accolades that my fantastic partner has, but believe me, I am very thankful of being on the show and to talk about you guys tonight.
So let's lead off. We have a lot of stuff to talk about. You know, of course, the lockout, the free agent frenzy right before, as well, of course, as the managerial names in the mix, but just basically within less than 2 hours ago, we heard that the 1969 Mets manager and all-time Brooklyn Dodger, Gil Hodges, has finally gotten into the Hall of Fame. And I want to start with you, Matt, here. It's just, what was it like when you heard that news? I'm sure you being a Mets fan, you know how, not only from the legacy standpoint that old Dodger fans have been talking about for so long, but so many Mets fans who witnessed the 1969 and just those early Mets teams, what it means today for Gil Hodges to get into the Hall of Fame.
I mean, it's truly incredible. Just hearing the opening between you guys just talking about it and talking about how tears were shed and how happy you are. Obviously, someone like myself is on the younger scale, me being 33, but the stories and constant stories I would hear from older Mets fans and friends of mine, like their parents, just hearing about the impact that Gil Hodges had and just knowing he had been on the ticket or the card, I should say, for so long. And it took what's it been, 35 years or 35 times he's on the card? Like, just knowing that this man is finally getting his moment and the story just – whenever you hear Bob Costas talking baseball, and I saw that clip before, and just knowing that his wife – living in the same house, 96 years of age, being able to experience that moment, and of, like you just said, the rest of the family, it's truly an incredible moment, and it's an awesome time to be able to see another Met going in.
John, for you, what are some of the memories when you see Gilha just getting in today? What was the first thing that you thought of?
You know, honestly, the first thing that I thought of was my grandfather. So, you know, I'm a Mets fan. I'm a baseball fan because of my grandfather. He taught me everything about baseball, and he was an old Brooklyn Dodger fan before the Mets ever came into existence, you know, all through the 30s, the 40s, and the early 50s. And he always used to say, you know, I could never root for the Yankees when the other two teams left because I was a Dodger fan, and back then you were a fan of one of the three teams and you hated the other two. And so, you know, just the symmetry there of going from the Brooklyn Dodgers as a player to the Mets as a manager, and it made me think of my grandfather, who's, you know, no longer with us, but, you know, it just kind of gave me in a weird way, a little bit of a sense of pride as a Mets fan, and also somebody who, you know, my life journey connected to the Dodgers is a little strange because I'm from Brooklyn, born and raised, and now I live out in Los Angeles myself. So, you know, there's a little bit of symmetry there, and it just felt really nice that this guy finally gets his due. I mean, basically a Hall of Famer as a player if you don't even start with the managerial stuff. So the fact that it took this long is absurd, but, you know, quite literally, better late than never.
Better late than never, indeed. Mike, I know I ask you to tell this story so much, and it never gets old for me, and especially on a night like tonight, and this is the first time we're having our guest on. I know what this means to you. It's bittersweet because he wasn't around to see it happen.
Oh, boy. Okay, once upon a time, I lived on East 45th and Snyder Avenue in East Flatbush. And this one April day in 1972, I'm going to be 6 years old. And the grown-ups, parents of the block took whatever kids were out. And it was a dead-end block. So it's just like a city park. You don't go down that block unless you live there. So the street was a perfectly safe place to be. All the, like I said, the parents, the grown-ups, all the adults gathered all us kids together. And we walked up Snyder Avenue in mass. And what I saw were the limos go by of Gil Hodges' funeral, headed towards Holy Cross Cemetery. So it wasn't until we got back on the block that they started explaining to me and us what exactly is it that we saw. And it was explained to me that was Gil Hodges' funeral. And that's when my education began about Gil Hodges and the Brooklyn Dodgers. I was already a Mets fan, Mets fan from birth. So I already had that affiliation, but, you know, I had no idea he was manager of the Mets, and here I am. And like I said, that was the beginning of my education. And lo and behold, as a single-digit child, he was laid to rest within 2,000 feet or so from where I lived. And growing up in Brooklyn, you know, Gil Hodges was inescapable, his legend, his legacy. His name was inescapable. We have a bridge named after him. Again, various art murals, a portion of Bedford Avenue named after him. I hung out in his bowling alley on Ralph Avenue in Avenue M. So Gil Hodges was somebody to us, even though Brooklynites of my age never got to see him play or manage, for that matter. I was still too young for that. But such a big part of my life starting that day. And, you know, again, as a teen, his legacy, his legend, his name was inescapable. So you grew up with Gil Hodges as part of your daily vernacular. Whether you played for Gil Hodges, Little League, or on that field, or against them, inescapable. So, yeah, as a Brooklynite, this is personal, and it's a celebration. And, again, I'm happiest for his family who got to witness this.
Yeah, as Bob Costas was saying, Joan is still living on that Bedford Avenue home that they that they held so dear. John, I want to go back to you. You know, I do a Brooklyn podcast as well, and a lot of times with Mike. And I want you to go a little deeper into your Brooklyn experience, your Brooklyn history, and what you know about Gil Hodges' connection to that.
Man, where do I start? So yeah, I mean, I was born in Diker Heights, Brooklyn. Grew up mostly there and in Bensonhurst as well. And I really never left until I moved out here to California just a couple of years ago. And you know, if situations were a little different, if I did something a little different for work, I probably would never leave. I love Brooklyn. It's the best, the absolute best place in the world as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, I went to school downtown, some of the places Mike was just talking about. You know, that's where my grandmother and my grandfather grew up, just right in the shadow of Ebbets Field, right there. And, you know, the stories that they would tell me about, you know, watching players, like my grandmother said, you know, players would come down the street, like when she was a kid, you know, my grandmother was probably 10 years old, and, you know, she would see players like just walking down the street from the Dodgers and just being like up close, like just like they were a part of the fabric of the neighborhood back then. You know, you can just, you go to the grocery store and you'd bump into somebody, and, you know, it's a shame in a way that, you know, baseball is no longer that romantic, and it's, you know, times have changed obviously a million times over since then. But, you know, again, it's just, I'm very close. My grandmother is still with us, and I'm very close to my grandparents. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with stories like that of the Brooklyn Dodgers, of, you know, my grandfather going to games at Ebbets Field as a kid. And then, you know, again, just the symmetry of myself going to college down in Brooklyn Heights and being, you know, kind of in that same general area. It's just, yeah, such an amazing part of my childhood and my baseball life for somebody who, like Mike was saying, like, I didn't watch Gil manage, and I certainly didn't watch Gil play, but it really felt as though I did sometimes hearing stuff from my grandma and grandpa.
And, of course, I kid when I say that you abandoned Brooklyn for Los Angeles just like the Dodgers. But, again, you know. And in that, you know, Matt, I've been reading I wish I had exactly, but it's the Walter O'Malley book about not only a biography, really, of him, but specifically about the transition out to the West. And one of the things they said, Matt, is that there was really a lot of cynicism, believe it or not, that at the time, not everybody was really paying attention to the possibility that the Dodgers were going to leave. And here we are with the CBA. You know, it's kind of a nuanced segue in some fashion from what we were talking about, but that seems to be a lot of the transition that brought the Dodgers out to Los Angeles is can be partially seen. The foundations of it is from then are now, you know, just basically blossoming into the second major labor issue we've had in the last 60 years for Major League Baseball.
Yeah, it's just we've been talking about it on our show, and I'm, you know, the constant shows I listen to when it comes to covering the Mets are all hitting on it as well. And it's just I don't even know where to go in terms of my thoughts, because I'll leave it at what I said on our last show when we were talking with Jay Horowitz. It's just like, it's incredible to me that as we're talking about a game that has evolved so much over these years, like we're talking about Gil Hodges now and how things have changed dramatically. And a lot of times it's, some of it's for the better, some of it's for the worse, but the fact that this game generates so much money and there's so many hands that are being put up for, you know, for wanting things, whether it's the players, whether it's the owners, whatever it may be, the fact that we're in this spot where we just watched owners dish out $1.7 billion and it happened in such a flurry, and obviously we as Mets fans were able to, in, you know, be happy with our owner spending close to $250 million in a four-day span, which is great for us. But the fact that it all ended so quick, and now we're basically in the dark, and we have no idea when the lights are going to get turned back on. But, you know, someone like me, I always feel that no matter what, I'm always championing for the players, because I find it hard to really be backing billionaire owners. But you know, there's a lot of blood on a lot of hands in this entire situation. And you know, when is it going to end? I'm not sure, but you know, I hope that smarter heads prevail in the end, and we can see baseball, you know, on time, and hopefully the lights turn back on so we can continue all the fun with free agency.
You know, Manfred's trying to play down, Mike, the idea that this is happening in the off season, that there is any jeopardy of any games being missed. But how do you see it?
I mean, I feel as though in terms of like that happening, I just think that, you know, it helps that it is this dark time, but at the same time, I feel like a lot of fun happens for Major League Baseball in the offseason with the rumors and the signings and everything. So the idea of it happening now is, yeah, no games might not be in jeopardy, but at the same time, we're kind of losing all that fun that brings eyes to the game because of all the movement.
Mike, where are you on this?
Manfred works for the owners. Let's not forget that. He's promoting their wish, their vision. Unfortunately, I have recollection of all the labor stoppages back to 1972. And the only reason why I remember 72 is because of my uncles and how they ranted and railed about it. So that memory and what they say stayed with me. But I certainly remember 81 and, you know, all the subsequent labor stoppages. I'm going to continue blowing this trumpet, Sam. This goes back to the 1870s to the 1880s and the dawning of the reserve clause. Not much has changed. The owners are always looking for ways to protect themselves from themselves. If they're giving somebody $40 million a year, that's because they're making more. And they're just looking to protect themselves from themselves. You know, go back to college or even high school. Grading on a curve. Everyone knows what I mean by grading on a curve. There's some people at one end. Most of the people are in the middle, and there's some people at the other end. No different with Major League Baseball owners. Most of them are bunched up in the middle, and most of them are bunched up in these central divisions. Those are the ones who cry loudest. Because if you look at these spenders, they're routinely from the East and West Coast. So, you know, let's not forget what this is. This isn't a strike. This is a lockout. So I ask people to recall how MLB imperialized minor league baseball. Instead of working with them and allowing them to collectively bargain their work conditions, look what they did. And, you know, they handed them a token raise. You know, minor leaguers still live below or near the poverty rate, but they have stipends and things of that nature. So look at what MLB did to the minor leagues. Think of that for their mindset going forward into this negotiation. They locked out the union. That is a tactic. So whatever Manfred says, you know, he's just an alchemist for the owners. That's all he is. He works for them. So, you know, a lot of what he says goes in one ear and out the other. Ultimately, you know, they didn't have to called this lockout. They could have negotiated in good faith, but they chose not to. And that's why I ask everyone, please recall how they treated the minor leagues. And this is the same route method that they're looking to take with the union. I'll leave it at that.
Mike, considering that we're going to have a lot of time to fill this offseason with, it sounds like, non-moves to talk about, a.k.a. the historical context that we've talked about, I just also had an idea that you sprung on me to talk about some of, you know, try to get a deep talk with somebody about those minor league conditions that you talk about. And the reserve clause, John, it's crazy how all of this just goes back. And I think about what Manfred said about free agency and it being one of the more negative aspects, which is why he wants one of the reasons why the owners don't want to give free agency until about age 29 or something like that. And all you can think of is that they still like that is their way of covering up the fact that they wish the reserve clause still existed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was one of the most absurd things that I have ever heard anyone say ever. And I don't, that's not hyperbole. I'm not limiting it to baseball or to this situation in baseball. I mean, quite frankly, there are three ways to go about building a baseball team if you boil it down to its simplest form, right? You draft players or sign players internationally, right? You do that at the very beginning, the outset of their career, or you can make trades with players that you have for other players that other people have, or you can sign free agents. So for the commissioner of the sport to come out and say that one of the three avenues of team building is something that they are so fundamentally against is just wild. And it's consistent with everything Manfred's ever done, which is a joke. It's consistent with the fact that baseball looks for love in all the wrong places. Sometimes I think nobody hates baseball and wants to grow baseball less than the people who run Major League Baseball. And Mike made a great point. I mean, you look at what they're trying to do with the minor leaguers, what they're trying to do now, and how they're trying to cry woe is me with the major leaguers. You know, this is a sport, but it's also a job. This is not indentured servitude, okay? And maybe back in the 90s and early 2000s, and we can talk about, you know, the merits or the lack thereof of steroids, but when guys were getting big free agent deals at 32, 33, 34, 35, 37 years old, still getting big free agent deals, maybe you could say, okay, you know, they didn't make a lot of money when they were 25, but what's the big deal? Now you have guys come up 22, 23 years old, and they hit free agency early, and they're great players. They're carrying teams to championships. They're winning MVPs. They're winning Cy Youngs, and they're making not a lot of money. Now, I understand to you, to me, to Ibby, to Mike, it is a lot of money. It certainly is. And that's the other thing I want to say is just caution fans who are listening to this. Because sports are the way they are and everybody follows their teams, you know what players make. And it's easy to say, oh, the players are being greedy. Max Scherzer just got $43 million. How much more do you want? Well, you know what? Baseball players and athletes in general have a finite amount of time to make money doing the thing that they have trained their entire life to do. And I'm not saying that salaries haven't exploded to the absurd. You know, when we talk about it on Till Mets Do His Part and we're like, yeah, somebody got $400 million or whatever. Like, it's crazy. We're talking about it like it's Monopoly money. But let's remember, like you said, that the owners who are signing these deals, no one's forcing them to do it. And every single owner in baseball is a billionaire with a B. Okay, so for them to come out there and cry poverty, there's no such thing as poor owners. There's just owners that cry poor. And it's ridiculous that they act the way that they do. Baseball teams and sports franchises are not great return on investment things. If you want to go invest in something else, if you're just worried about making money back and buying another yacht, there's plenty of ways for you to invest your money. Investing in a sports franchise and investing in a baseball team means that you're going to take losses along the way, and it means that you have to put money back into the team. That's why I love what Steve Cohen has come out and said, where he's like, I've got a job. I make money. The Mets are not here for me to make money. It is so refreshing to hear something like that, especially with the backdrop. You know, I know he said that a year ago, but with the backdrop of the lockout looming and now that we're in it, it is so refreshing to have an owner that just gets it and says, look, I know I've got more money than most people will ever see, but what I'm trying to do is help, you know, bring Mets fans or, you know, just the team that I own. I'm trying to bring those fans joy with the money that I have. It's a weird way. I'm not trying to equate it to charity because it's certainly not that, but it's a way of giving back. And too many owners, you know, want to take the money that they get over the luxury tax threshold and they pocket it, or, you know, they go buy another house, or like I said, they go buy another boat. And it's like, that's not what it's for. So, you know, I blame Manfred, and I blame a lot of those owners in the small markets that, you know, look, I get market size can be smaller. Not every place is New York, L.A., Chicago, Boston, et cetera. they might draw less, but it doesn't mean that they have less money. It's absurd.
That it is. Matt, can I call you Ibby? Is that okay?
Yes, you may call me Ibby. That is fine.
All right, Ibby. So I want you to take it away. Your podcast partner just had his. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's hard for me not to echo everything that he just said, because it's a lot of stuff that we've been talking about on Till Mets, and it's just – there's one thing that I said that really bothered me, and when the tweet was put out right after Max signed, and it was like, oh, he's making $43 million a year. And then you see that's more money than what Cleveland, Baltimore, and Pittsburgh is going to be putting out on the field in general. It's like – that's not my problem. That's not my fault or any other Mets fan's fault. That's not Steve Cohen's fault. It's the fault of those owners. I'm pretty sure the Cleveland owner is one of the top five richest owners in the sport. You are choosing to field the team, I'm not going to say ineptitude, because they have great pitching. They have great players like Jose Ramirez. They have a good farm system. They're choosing not to go out and spend the money. Now, I also agree with John when he says not every team is built the same, because not everyone is New York or L.A. I understand that. But there's one thing that always talks in sports, and that is money. If you have a player on your team that you truly want to keep, and you've had that person for, based off the rules right now, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, depending on when they get called up or whatever, you have your opportunity to build that relationship and show that player the money. Just like I always bring this back to – I bring it back to Joe Mauer and thinking about a team like Minnesota. Minnesota also has one of the richest owners in the sport, but they're always viewed as a small market team. And back then, the idea of keeping Joe Mauer seemed like it was insane, because when he became a free agent, he was coming off that crazy MVP-type year. He put up crazy numbers. Minnesota kid, they thought, oh, teams like Boston, teams like the Yankees, the Dodgers, all the big-name teams were going to sign him. But then guess what? The Twins open up the pocketbook, and yeah, 2020, Monday morning quarterbacking it, you could say, well, you know, was he worth $180 million? No, he wasn't, but they ponied up, and they paid him at the time what was the appropriate amount of money. Now, any team can do that. It's just that teams are choosing not to do that because they all want to adapt to that, whether you want to call it the Rays or you want to call it the Astros, what they did when the Astros lost, you know, 4 or 5 years in a row, and there's probably like 400 losses in there, and then they were able to build everything up and, you know, become a little more sustainable in terms of what they wanted to do. But at the same time, I'm with John in saying there's no such thing as, you know, mid-market teams or mid-market owners or just not having enough money. Everybody has money. You are a billionaire. You are choosing not to spend that money. And that is what, in my opinion, is hurting the game, because I think all these teams can be on a somewhat playing field. Look, there's always going to be the allure of other places. And if a player wants to go to a bigger spot, I get that. That happens in any sport. But at the same time, I do believe that teams have the inside track to keep a player if they truly wanted them. They just have to show them the money. And a lot of these teams are choosing not to show them the money.
You are listening to the Metsian Podcast as we come up to close to the half hour. And I'm going to go back to our featured guests, Till Mets Do Us Part, John Sapinaro and Matt Ibanez, a.k.a. Ibby. And I'm going to start with you, John. Give us your shameless plug slash Mets history, New York history. I know we got a little into it at the beginning, but please tell our audience all about you and where they can find you.
Perfect. So you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at John Sapinaro. My name is unique enough that I don't need any numbers afterwards. So it's JohnSapinaro. You can also check out my website, which is just my name, John Sapinaro, spelt the same way, johnsapinaro.com. And, of course, you can listen to my podcast alongside of Ibby, which is Till Mets Do Us Part. You can hear it every week, every Thursday. We come out on all the places that you get your podcast, whether it's Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, all those things. And I know we're not exactly talking this right now, but I know there is a big overlap, a lot of folks like myself who are not only Mets fans, but New York Jets fans. And I host another great podcast on the Chop Sports Network as well, which is called The Goddamn Jets, and it is dedicated to that dreadful, dreadful green and white football team. So, so you guys can listen to us. You know, that show comes out every Wednesday. So we've got the Jets podcast every Wednesday, and the Mets podcast every Tuesday. And if you follow me on social media, you'll always keep abreast of all the things that I've got going on. And I've been both a fan of both of those teams, and they're the teams I care about the most for my entire life. And I usually tell women when I go out on first dates, I said it doesn't speak a lot to my ability to make decisions, but it does speak a lot to my commitment levels. So that's something that you should be aware of. J-E-T-S, Jets, 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 I say with exacerbated breath, of course. Thank you, John. And let's go to Matt, Ibby, please. Same spiel, shameless plug, your Mets fan history, your New York history. Tell everybody where they can find you.
Yeah, sure thing. When it comes to finding me, you can find me on Instagram as well as Twitter, at Poison, P-O-I-S-O-N, underscore Ibby, I-B-B-Y. And, of course, obviously following the show account, which is where I tweet a lot of times when it comes to the Mets and during the Mets games as well. And that's at Kill Mets Do Us Part. Same thing on Instagram as well as a Facebook group. I run a Facebook group as well. Till Mets Do Us Part, probably close to about 100 people. I like to keep it nice and intimate, if you will, to try and get as many, what I like to call, educated and smart, not so much negativity. I know it's tough to do when it comes to Mets fans. We have a lot of pessimism within the fan base, and Mets Twitter is, has its ups and downs, but we've got a lot of good people in there, so there's always information and good conversation going on there as well. In terms of me as a fan, if we're going to get into it, obviously John was talking about his upbringing in Brooklyn and all that good stuff. For me, Jersey kid, grew up, I'm 33 years old. I would say probably around, call it 96, 97, 98, around that area is when I started getting into baseball. And obviously I've been playing baseball ever since. And then, around that time, you have a lot of people around you, growing up, late elementary school, early middle school, where I'm surrounded by a lot of Yankee fans. And if there's something I can say about myself, I've always been somebody that is against the grain. I didn't like conforming to what everyone else was doing, so I always like to go opposite. So when I'm surrounded by a bunch of Yankee fans, I decided to become a Mets fan. And, that's why I really hopped in and started understanding the game more and more when it came to that 99-2000 team, the black jerseys, Piazza, all that fun. And obviously the Subway Series. And then, it took off from there. Been a diehard ever since. And, fortunate enough to be hosting a show on the great Chop Sports Network with a great partner in John Sapanaro.
Nice. And, John, I was saying it like a classic Italian pronunciation, Sapanaro. So I know exactly how to properly pronounce it. So I'm gonna start again with you, Matt, here as we segue to what we discussed that both of us really haven't discussed on air yet, all of us haven't discussed on air yet, and that is Javi Baez and Marcus Stroman going somewhere else. So I'll start with you, Matt, and I know you said a lot of things that echoed, I believe it was you specifically on the podcast, that Marcus's tweeting leading up to that was a bit odd, in that it seemed like he had already decided that both parties maybe had moved on, basically. So anyway, go ahead with both signings elsewhere.
I think it's really saying a lot, because I think it was Tim Healy who put out the recent article talking about the clubhouse chemistry and things like that. You're noticing a trend that a lot of people that were on this team that were that were going to be free agents are now pretty much out the door, it seems like, and, I'm assuming Conforto's out the door as well, but I think that alone speaks volumes. But yeah, when it came to Stroman, we talked about it on the show, and it came across extremely odd, the way he was handling things, and he came across very bitter, as if it's not a business. And at the same time, look, you have your connections within your team, you think you have a relationship within the front office, maybe, but at the same time, no matter what, it's a business, and they get to you when they get to you. And I just felt like he was living way too much on Twitter, I mean, a lot of us do, but him specifically, and just the reactions that he was having came across, you know, childish in a way, because look, I have no problem with a player controlling the information that's coming out on them and wanting to be in front of that. I have no problem with that. I thought it was improper to just be tearing down people that the Mets were rumored to be talking to. And I think a lot of times he was taking rumor as fact, and I thought it really hurt him and pretty much burned bridge in terms of the idea of him coming back. But, you know, it seemed as though he was very open in, you know, saying things about the Gausman rumors and any other pitcher. But you also noticed he was pretty quiet when the Mets were, you know, pretty much close to signing and then eventually signing Max Scherzer. He didn't say a damn word in that sense. So I think it was just him trying to hold up his end and thinking that he was the best of the best in terms of who they were playing with or who they were potentially signing. So I have no problem with him thinking that you're the best. I mean, you're in a profession, you want to be the best, but I thought he could have went about a different way in handling that. And in terms of Baez, I said it to John, and I think this sums up best. It was a summer fling. We thought he would have been staying, but he's out the door. I'm not that broken up about it because I think that this team has its head on its shoulders and knows what they want to do. So I'm pretty confident that they are going to use that money and allocate it elsewhere to better this team.
I would agree with you, John. Go ahead with the Javi Baez and Marcus Stroman.
Yeah, so, you know, when the offseason started and even leading up to it, Ibby and I talked a lot on the podcast about how those two guys were absolute must re-signs for the Mets, and for various different reasons each, right? So Stroman obviously stepped in admirably in Jacob deGrom's shoes and really filled the role of ace. He was very consistent. He was a terrific personality, I think. I know a lot of people have problems with the way he acts, but, you know, I think he's a New York personality, obviously being from Long Island. And I thought he brought something different than what DeGrom brings in terms of, you know, DeGrom is so quietly confident and he's got, you know, simple man, and that's, you can't find him in the off season. And I like a staff, a starting rotation made up of different personalities. And I like baseball teams made up of different personalities. I think that stuff is all important. I also thought I bought into the hype that we were not going to be able to get Max Scherzer. And so for me, just me picking and looking at free agents, Marcus Stroman was the second best free agent starter behind Max Scherzer. So I looked at it as a must bring back in that regard. So all of that changes completely when they go out and they get Scherzer. Now, after they sign Scherzer, it's ironic because Marcus Stroman really does become the perfect person to pitch in the number three spot in the rotation behind DeGrom and Scherzer. I think he is built for that, and I think he's a great change of pace in terms of style of pitcher from those two guys. But like Ibby was saying, and we talked about on our show, it seemed as though he was upset that the Mets made an offer to Max, the Mets made an offer to Gausman, the Mets gave the qualifying offer to Syndergaard, and the Mets were flirting heavily with Scherzer, and where was Stroman's offer? So it's clear that the Mets were ready to move on, and if they were always going to go big game hunting, which, again, I didn't buy into as far as Scherzer was concerned, I don't think there was ever a place for or an avenue for Stroman to come back in that sense. As far as Baez goes, right now Baez is the only player that they are not retaining that I'm upset about. Simply because, and I'm not upset at the Mets. The Mets have done so much. They've spent almost $250 million. They've made their team better in so many ways, and they're not done. Which anybody who's lived through the Wilpons like we all have, that is an absurd sentence in and of itself that I can say that with confidence. So, you know, I can't be mad at the Mets. And I'm not mad at Javi Baez for everything I said before about the lockout. Go out and get as much money as you absolutely can. I'm just mad as a Mets fan because I love Javi Baez. I think he is the perfect mixture of pure athleticism and incredibly high baseball IQ. The guy plays with such a fast motor and such intelligence on the field in every aspect of his game that I think it's a loss. And it's a bummer because watching him play is something that I think, for me as a baseball fan, the type of fan that I am, he is must-watch television. And watching him, you know, up the middle with Lindor And, you know, after they signed Marte, especially, you look at that up-the-middle defense, James McCann, you know, very underrated defensive player compared to what we've had at catchers in the past. So, you know, that really locks down the middle of the field. But I do think that the Mets are going to, quote-unquote, replace him. I do think they're going to spend on another big bat. I'd like to see it be Chris Bryant. And if they do go out after the lockout's over and acquire a guy like Bryant, I'm not really going to be – I think that'll wash away the last bit of upset that I have about Javi Baez. The only thing that scares me is that while they've made their team better with the signings of Canna and Escobar and Marte, they haven't really replaced Baez. I thought Baez fit perfectly as the fourth position player that they could have signed. And so I'm looking for them to upgrade somewhere, and I think the obvious answer is Chris Bryant.
Mike, it's always the perfect segue to go to you when somebody mentions Chris Bryant. I'll start here specifically with Javi Baez. I agree with John that I just really did love watching him as a ball player. And considering I was saying off air, he went to the Tigers, I can still kind of tune in if I have access and be able to enjoy watching Javi Baez. And I like what the Tigers are doing. I don't know what the Cubs are doing. We all know they're kind of in a rebuild phase and Marcus Stroman goes there. I thought it'd be interesting to angle it your way that way with those two. And I will also add with Chris Bryant, I think the outfield part, the fact that Chris Bryant is not necessarily married to third base, what say you, considering what you've said on this podcast and what I'm sure you'll bring up now?
Well, I'll start there then. Third base. I don't care what they do for as long as they don't log jam it. I don't want them interfering with the eventual graduation to the major leagues of Brett Beatty or Vientos, one or the other. I want that position open, just like the Mets opened it and handed it to Ahmed Rosario, with no detours, potholes, just smooth road. Here's the position. It's yours. Go seize the day. And that's the way I want third base treated because of these two particular prospects, Brett Beatty, Mark Vientos. Okay, so, you know, if I would be opposed to the acquisition of Chris Bryant if the goal is to seat him at third base for, you know, an extended period of time. What do I mean by that? 3 years. These guys are right around the corner. Vientos sooner than Beatty. You know, so I don't want that scenario. If you want to play him, if you want to play Chris Bryant in left field and stick Nimmo in right, okay. Just don't interfere with third base. Please, I beg you. Treat it the way you did with Ahmed Rosario. Just hand him the position and say, here, win the day. Seize the moment. That's what I want. Baez, I'm not going to dwell. I left off saying, I wanted him in this transitory period. You know, because for me, all eyes are on Billy Epler. So it's less for me a Baez issue or a Stroman issue or even a Noah Syndergaard issue, etc. All eyes are on Billy Epler. I like working from the top down. So now that Mr. Cohen has a president who's off doing other things and now has a general manager, all eyes are on him. And if he decides that Stroman or Baez or any of these guys that, you know, are dearly departed from Metsville, you know, if he didn't envision them fitting into the plan, well, that's on him. And for the moment, I will side with the general manager. I think that's only fair. Matt brought up a good point. You know, there is such a thing as resetting the mood of the room. And perhaps some of those personalities, some of those exiting personalities, you know, were part of the problem. I've say that with the question mark. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. I'm just posing. So to me, it's a Billy Epler thing. I want to see him build. He's gotten started. What's his next move? That's where, you know, these guys been there, done that. Once you you know, go through the exit door. That's it. You're in my rearview mirror. So I'm not going to dwell. The last person I dwelt about was Zach Wheeler. And again, you can point your fingers right back at the front office. Different situation now. Who's in charge? Not to say that he was my first, one of my first 10 candidates, but he's here and he's now and he's in charge. So let's see where he takes this from, you know, moving forward. So Baez, I'm not dwelling. We still have to consider Robinson Cano. He is the hockey stick in the spokes.
Yep.
Who knows what's going to happen with that? You know, so you still have to take him into consideration, unfortunately. So I'm not dwelling about Stroman. We had pitching problems prior to his exit. We have pitching problems today. You know, so pitching problems are pitching problems. Address them. How? That's up to Billy Eppler.
Oh, man, pitching problems, that's a whole other hour, right? Ibby, I'm going to go to you next here. And Billy Eppler is the perfect segue because I, you know, just like looking at it retrospectively now that the lockout has started and that a pause has been set specifically on his player acquisition. However, mm-hmm. the Mets played this perfectly and absolutely, blitzed the free agent market, knowing, as everybody was saying, that nobody wanted to go. The narrative was nobody wanted to go to the Mets because they didn't even have a manager. But they saw an opportunity to lock up with money and potentially some clubhouse guys, as has been reported with Escobar and Cana. And, of course, Scherzer is an ultimate clubhouse guy. So now Billy Eppler can set forth on the managerial candidates, and I'll list some here that have been reported, and it sounds like Curtis Granderson's name was ping-ponged around just because we all do love Curtis Granderson, but it might not just be there yet, and I kind of agree because I personally think they do this time need to go with experience. And so the names that have been first reported by Andy Martino, of course, is Joe Espada, Houston Astros bench coach, Buck Showalter, free agent manager, Matt Quatraro, Tampa Bay Rays bench coach, Don Kelly, Pittsburgh Pirates bench coach, and Brad Ausmus, free agent manager, of course. So I'll start with you, Ibby. What are you thinking here? And especially, you know, the Mets are not done with the team they're assembling, but they're I can't say halfway done. I can't say three quarters done. I don't know. Who knows exactly where they are? But any manager at this point, I believe, would want this challenge.
Absolutely, and I think based off of how they're building already, you're seeing that they're trying to work within a window, and it seems as though that window is ranging anywhere from 2 to 4 years. So, yeah, you take on some older players, accomplished players, like you said, clubhouse guys. You're trying to make this a situation that anyone would want to come into, and I think any one of those managers would want this job. I've said this on the show, on our show, multiple times, and I'm going to continue to echo it, and then obviously I'll put forth my thought on where they might be going. My thought process is when it comes to managers, I don't think that that what they bring is what they used to bring. Like, this isn't the days of Billy Martin anymore. I think it's a little bit different. So what I'm looking for and what I want is I just want somebody there that, number one, knows how to talk in a post-game presser, because I think 9 times out of 10, whenever somebody gets mad at the manager and want to point fingers at the manager, because the person doesn't know how to speak in front of all the writers and everything in a post-game presser. That's number one. But really, number two, it's I want somebody that is in lockstep with whatever the front office vision is, because that is what the game is now. Everything's coming from the front office. Everybody knows that. As long as the person that's down in the field is together with what the vision of the front office is, I think things are going to be okay. Like, everyone automatically always goes to somebody like Alex Cora and how, oh, you saw when he went away that the Red Sox were bad, then he came back. You see the impact that he has. And I can easily just say, well, I can also say that that's somebody that front office new, and you know, he works with, you know, he assembles and he works well with Heim Bloom now. It's like that's just something that works because it's with the vision that the team has from the overall standpoint. As long as the Mets have that, that's all I care about. That could be, you know, Joe Blow. It doesn't matter who it is. Like, as long as that is whatever the front office wants and it's what they want to put forth on the field, I'm fine with that. Now, what I think and where my feelings are right now in terms of where they might be going, because of what I just said, the way that this team is being built, a little bit on the older side, but veteran presence and things like that. I know my partner is not going to like this, but I'm going to say that I think the leader in the clubhouse right now is probably John Sapanow's favorite manager, and that is Buck Showalter.
Oh. well, John, firstly, I would preface that I didn't mention Marte, who Starlin Marte, who is of course supposed to be a good clubhouse guy too. But go ahead with the managerial candidates.
Well, I actually think the managerial candidate is summed up a lot by what we've been talking about. So Mike made some really great points earlier about not blocking prospects, 3-4 years from now. Ibby made the similar comments about signing guys to shorter-term deals who are more veteran players. I think there is a clear path and a vision of what Billy Epler and the Mets are trying to build, where they're trying to win in the short term. They've been trying to bolster this good but flawed major league team by acquiring quality players for money while holding on to prospects and holding on to draft picks. It is what smart teams do, and I think that that will give you insight as to who they want to manage this team. Now, having said that, I don't put a lot of stake on somebody who has managed at the major league level before, but I do think, to echo what Ibby was saying, they do need somebody who has managerial experience. So while I think a guy like Curtis Grandison would be fantastic in the clubhouse, he's such a great presence. He's such a well-liked individual. Obviously, he's on TV. He handles the media well. He always has been a spokesperson for all the player, all the teams he's ever played on. You know, I think he checks a lot of boxes, but the X's and O's is too much of a question mark for me to go in that direction. Now, having said that, again, it doesn't have to necessarily be major league managerial experience. I do like guys like Joe Espada or Joe McEwing who have been bench coaches for a long time. I'm willing to go with somebody who has been a longtime minor league manager. I think there's more than one way to skin a cat when you're getting managers, you know, especially from other franchises, if you're going and elevating somebody's bench coach. I don't like Buck Showalter simply because I don't like the way he is championed. Buck Showalter has done a lot in baseball, and I'm sure Buck Showalter knows a lot about baseball. And I'm not going to sit here and sound ageist and say the game is passed him by or anything like that, but Buck Showalter also has won nothing, sometimes with very good teams. And so the frustrating part for me is I'll go on Mets Twitter and I'll see a lot of people saying Buck is exactly what we need. And then in the same breath, they'll be like, well, I don't want Bruce Bochy. And it's like, so you're willing to say that you will take on a guy who's been out of baseball, who's anti-analytics, who's an old-school baseball man, who's won nothing, but you won't do the same thing for a guy that's got 3 World Series wins. To me, that makes no sense. The logic is flawed, and you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. Now, to Ibby's point, I am trying over the last several days to talk myself into being okay with Buck Showalter because I do think that he is the leader in the clubhouse, and I do think that there's a strong indicator that he may be the next manager of the Mets. And, you know, again, short term, 3 or 4 years, it may not be the absolute worst thing. And it goes back to what Mike was saying before. I don't care where the manager comes from, and I don't care who the manager is. I just want them to get it right. So I felt the same way about Billy Epler. I feel the same way. I've said this on my Jets podcast when the whole Mike White situation was unfolding. I said, I don't care if the Jets get a franchise quarterback from the number two overall pick, a guy that they signed off the practice squad from Dallas, or a guy who is stocking shelves at Ralph's when I go get groceries later. I just want them to have a franchise quarterback. And that's how I feel about the Mets. I just want them to get the choice right. If it's Buck Showalter and he leads them to the promised land, I will gladly say that I was wrong for the Mets to walk away with a World Series championship.
That's exactly what we're hoping can happen right here. Mike, you know, everything you've heard, everything you've before said about it, go ahead. What is your feeling now as the Mets have put the free agent stuff aside, unfortunately, because of a lockout, and now they can focus solely on the managerial case because they're not locked out. So what say you?
Let me put on my old curmudgeon boots for a second here. Let me screw around with everybody. Somebody said, Madame Blavatsky, upon her exit from America, she said, I love America. I love freedom. But you know what? You Americans have too much of it. Do your homework. Find out what I'm talking about, folks. Anyway, there's something to be said for regaining command and control of the clubhouse. Because by itself, Pete Alonso and his hitting coach is nothing. By itself, McNeil and Lindor and whomever and Raccoon Gate, not much. By itself, Baez and whomever else and thumbs down isn't much. But cumulatively, it looks bad. And the previous manager couldn't command nor control the clubhouse. And we saw what happened. And not just one, two, three, but more. Minor incidences in themselves. But when you put them all together, it doesn't come off well. Not considering that win-loss record that went along with it. Okay, so whereas, look, we all know whoever the Mets hire as manager, they will not be the manager, or we hope they won't be the manager 3 years from now. We hope by then that the minor league system is starting to, you know, produce talent ready for the major leagues. And we want a new manager to take that condition forward. But we're talking short term. So I believe very much in regaining command and control of the locker room and players. Players, sometimes athletes in a team setting, are just like kids. They need to be bossed around, and most times they like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that as a former military person. There's a certain camaraderie that comes with good leadership. And boys, being boys, a lot of times, so I believe in command and control. Does he have to work or she have to work with the front office? Probably. Not to say that I'm, you know, pleased about it, but there's a balance between analytics and instinct and gut feeling and experience and in-game action, you know, having your eyes reveal to you what, you know, you think and see and feel. So, you know, there's a massaging of philosophies there. Yeah, I would like Buck Showalter because he would regain command and control of this locker room for several of the players who are still here to see that happen. And this is short term until the minor league system is up and ready. And then you bring somebody in new to march that team forward. But for now, that's what I want. Will a guy like Buck Showalter succumb to analytics? He'll work with the front office. He'll give them what they want. And in return, they, you know, his record doesn't need to speak for him. The respect he commands speaks for Buck Showalter. Forget that he hasn't won a champion. Talk to the players who played for him. That's what matters. You know, a resume can be very misleading at times. Talk to the players who've played for him. They'll tell you. They were happy to play for him. You know, they were willing to run through walls for him, and that's what you want. So, you know, short term is a minefield. It really is. One wrong move, and, you know, fans are going to blow up in this modern age. And, you know, right now I think we're still in a state of recovery. This is short-term tactics that we're undergoing. The real New York metropolitan teams will reveal itself 3 years from now. Let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets. You have been listening to the Metsian podcast. We're so thankful that you do. Please like and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And guys, we actually have a phone call. If you can stick around for a second, John and Matt, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Yeah, I got time.
All right, we got a 973 area code. You are here on the Metsian podcast. Go right ahead. I believe you can be heard now.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment from the lockout that happened since Thursday. I mean, we knew this was coming. I mean, no question about it. But it doesn't seem like, you know, that either side is even willing to communicate right now. And with the Mets signing those three players that total over $3 million, I mean, that's now, you know, like, everything is now on hold with that. So this is pretty damaging to the players, if anything. But the owners, I mean, they could have worked it out. They had all their time to work it out. But thanks to their own greed and stupidity, now that has come reality. I mean, they could have worked this during, you know, the pandemic, and they thought maybe the pandemic was going to save them because they were throwing money around as of last week. But still, they decided to close it down at, last Thursday. And Wednesday, they only met for 7 minutes. Now, you were not going to be able to solve anything in that short amount of time. So this, you know, is a... It's a sad week for all of us baseball fans out there.
I agree with you. And what is your name, sir?
I'm sorry. My name is Lou. I've been here before. It's been a while, though.
Oh, Lou. So we're with 973. I guess that's somewhere in Jersey, right?
Northern New Jersey, yes. About an hour from Manhattan on a good day. On a bad day, don't ask.
That's great, Lou. Well, Do you have any questions for anybody on the staff tonight on the round table?
Well, I came in late, so I assume that you might have been thinking about how the deals were made, I assume.
Well, right now we were just about to basically, you know, start wrapping things up and talk about, they basically check in with everybody to see if everything's been covered. If you just hang on a second, I'm going to go around and see what anybody else wants to cover.
All right. I can wait. Sure.
All right. Awesome, man. Well, Matt, I'm going to start with you, Ibby. Please. Is there anything you want to touch upon before we end the night?
I feel like we covered a lot of our bases. Obviously the, you know, like, caller was just saying it sucks that things have come to the stop, like we talked about with the lockout, and, you know, how like Mike mentioned before, you know, it's a tactic, you know, the owners close the door on the players, like that's what it is. That's why it's called a lockout. You're locking the players out. So at least the one thing as Mets fans that we can continue to get lost in is this managerial and, you know, the bench coaches and then filling out the rest of the staff. At least we as fans have something to get excited about in terms of how that's all going to play about and who's going to be leading everything and all that stuff. So at least we have that. But like I said before, during my points, I just hope that, you know, it's one thing if this goes dark for like the month of December and a little bit of January, then it gets figured out. But if we start getting into February, leaning towards March, and there's still no end in sight, just like the caller said, like, the fact that you're meeting for 7 minutes, 10 minutes, nothing's happening in that amount of time. Nothing at all. So I hope that things can get sorted out. We can get back to having some more fun. But like I said, at least as Mets fans, we have this managerial search and filling out the rest of the coaching staff search to, you know, wrap our heads around and get lost in.
Yeah, it's a good bookend considering that we opened basically, other than Miguel Hodges, jubilance. You know, it's followed by talking about something that's extremely sour with the CBA. So, John, anything else you want to touch upon?
Well, yeah, you know, I guess there's kind of a few things. I think the seven-minute meeting that they had is more of what Ball, the owners, and the players' union do terribly to each other, which is negotiating out in the public. You know, everybody knows that they're not going to be able to get anything done in 7 minutes, and we also didn't need to know that the meeting only lasted 7 minutes. It's just more posturing. It's just more BS that we're used to because they can't get on the same page, which is frustrating and, quite frankly, absurd. And who suffers? The fans suffer. And look, you know, Matt and I are in our mid-30s, and, you know, Mike said he's a fan from an older generation. We're fans. We're not going anywhere. But it's the younger fans that this hurts. You know, baseball talks about wanting to grow the game, and they do it in the worst way possible. Now, I live in Southern California now, and I could drive down the street and hit Mike Trout with my car, and I wouldn't even know it. You know, and he's been the best player in the sport for a decade. So it's so – and I love baseball, and I'd hit him, and it would take me a minute to realize it was him. So, you know, they've got real problems that they really need to address. Another thing that I just wanted to touch on quickly that somebody mentioned, you know, I am so happy, and Mets fans, hear me when I say this. Same old Mets, LOL Mets, it all died the day the Mets signed Max Scherzer. So don't let the media outlets tell you that nobody wants to play for this team. Don't let them tell you that Cohen tweeting is a problem or nobody wanted to take the GM job or players won't sign here because there isn't a manager. They didn't have a problem signing any players, not from what I could tell. They also, I mean, look, they were always going to have to overpay for Scherzer. Whoever brought him in was going to have to on a short-term deal. But when you look at the other three deals that they signed, they signed those three players for $124.5 million. The MLB trade rumor's estimate salary for those three players in the offseason was $124 million. And I understand that's just one outlet's projections, but the Mets paid fair market value to get three very good players. So this rhetoric that people don't want to play for the Mets or they don't want to come here because of the owner or because there isn't a manager, it is all complete and utter nonsense, and same old Mets died the day that they signed Max Scherzer. And the last thing I want to bring up is two words that I think is important for dealing with this lockout and fixing it, and the ultimate thing that I think will bring baseball into the next era, and that is salary floor. There has to be a minimum salary that these owners must invest into their team, period, end of story. It is ridiculous, like Ibby said, going all the way back to the beginning, that Max Scherzer is making more than some teams. That is absurd. And money is not the be-all, end-all. We know that as Mets fans. Pre-Madoff, the Mets invested some of the most money and had nothing to show for it. Top five payrolls every year. It does not mean that you're going to win. And if the Mets go out and have a $308 million salary this year, it's not going to matter. If their payroll is $308 million, it doesn't matter. It might help them win. It might not. But we have to force these other teams that are unwilling to invest in their team to invest in their team. We did it with the luxury tax. It's become so punitive for big market teams so that you look at teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox. They go, I'm not spending any money this year. Well, if you've made it so difficult for the teams that want to spend money to spend money, and then the teams that never wanted to spend money are not incentivized to do so, you only have three or four teams every year that go out and really try to win and try to capture people's emotions and hearts and get more fans in the offseason. All of that is a problem. They've made the luxury tax too punitive, and they haven't incentivized small market owners to spend any of the money that they're getting back as a result. And that is a frustrating mix of situations. And to that end, the best thing to come out of this lockout is what we just saw before the lockout happened. Major League Baseball has to find a way to bottle that, because that was the most exciting hot stove that we have seen in probably a decade. It works for the NBA. It works for the NFL in terms of free agent signing periods. MLB has to figure out a way to make the hot stove again.
I agree. You know, we were used to things sometimes waiting till January, sometimes even till February, sometimes even into spring training, which is extremely annoying. And I completely agree. And Mike, I'll start with you. Going over to you. Excuse me for a second. Going over to you, Mike. I think that the Francisco Lindor trade and signing needs to get more credit in setting the foundation for all of this. And also, anything else you want to touch upon before we go?
Well, they definitely created a market and established a price that other GMs observe, and, you know, they'll react to that, and they'll, you know, go about their business accordingly. So, yeah, in that sense, Steve Cohen and the Mets, they were market makers because of that acquisition and the subsequent contract. Agreed, you know, but again, right now, Steve Cohen is perhaps viewed as this financial outlier. Most of them are bunched in the middle. He's at one of the extremes. He's at the higher extreme. You have the lower extremes, like the teams that we mentioned that have a lower payroll than the average annual salary awarded to Max Scherzer. That's the other extreme. You know, we threw out Manfred's free agent folly, didn't we not? And the fact that they locked the players' union out, I'm forced to follow this train of thinking, that because it's a free agent matter, I have to go back to free agency, the dawn of free agency itself. What came after that? Work stoppages, collusion. Look around the landscape of baseball today. Everyone has a brand new ballpark, except Fenway, Wrigley, L.A., but those are profitable enterprises. Everyone else has a brand new ballpark. All these owners have their luxury boxes that they cried for. So, you know, their ability to pass free agency costs upon the fans, the moat separating the rich from the proletariat in all these ballparks that we visit these days, that has all reached its law of diminished returns. And hence why I think they've taken this approach, because it goes back to free agency and owners trying to protect themselves from themselves. You know, otherwise we're talking capitalism and free market enterprise. Let the market set the price. In a perfect world, you know, sports fans want their teams run like communists. And I mean that, you know, in jest, but one person in control, everybody else falls in line. Our team, we win together, yippee. It's not like that. This is capitalism, and this is part of it. But free agency is as much on their minds today as it was back in the early 70s. Per Rob Manfred. Nobody's making that up. And they've been trying to circumvent it ever since. First with collusion. They all got their new ballparks. They all got their luxury boxes. They all charged us out the ass to attend games. What is it now? $250 for a family of four to attend an average game? So all that has reached its law of diminished returns. What else are they going to do? So they turned their forces on the minor leagues, and now they're looking to turn their forces on the union. I've been on the other side of this argument when the players were on strike. I at times found myself on both sides of the fence. This time, their action is making me bring all this back into the forefront, because it's habitual behavior since day one. business, collective bargaining. Collective bargaining. They could have sat down at the table throughout all this time. But no. Look at their behavior in the past. They wait till 2 minutes to midnight to get something done. And somebody always feels like they got the short end of the stick.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no reason to think otherwise right now, especially when you look specifically at MLB's behavior over the last 2 years.
Well said, Mike. And Lou, we greatly appreciate you calling in. And before we let you go, it sounded like you wanted to get one more thing in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I thought, to be honest, I thought the Mets season was over after DeGrom got injured, because after that, they just fell apart. I mean, they were cruising along, you know, in April and May, and looked like they could be a shoo-in in the NL East Division, and they just fell apart right there. So basically, I think their season was over after DeGrom got injured. No, not later.
Yeah,
well,
I think DeGrom
and Lindor.
I also cite the fact that, yeah, exactly, Lindor. I was exactly what Mike said. Lindor, too. I think there was something
right
about the way he handled the pitching staff, even, on that infield. Again, you know, I think Lindor might have had a weird season in terms of his relationship with the
right
fans, and also in terms of his actual hitting.
Yes. And as I've often said through the years, you know, it doesn't matter what your payroll is, you know, if you make $300 million, or if you're not, you know, hitting the home runs or striking out your opponents, you're not doing a thing. So forget about, oh, we got the highest payroll, we're going to go out and get the best players, and we're going to win. No, that's ridiculous. That is the most absurd thing I ever heard. In all my years of covering, you know, all sports and podcasting, you know, that is still the most ridiculous, ludicrous statement I've ever heard.
I agree with you, man. I agree with you, and
yeah.
I'm going to give you go ahead.
And as far as with the 7-minute meeting, the way I sum it, I can say it like this. In my best Cartman imitation of South Park, screw this, I'm going home. And that's exactly what they did.
Hey, I appreciate the Cartman reference very much. It's
exactly
my favorite show of all time. So, Lou, thank you so much. And we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. So we greatly appreciate you joining us tonight.
Okay, hey, one more thing before I go. I have a show of my own Saturday nights, you know, if you're interested. It's called the Enhanced Sports Show. We're on Saturdays, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time. The number to call is 512-543-4662. The number again, 512-543-4662. No PIN numbers or code or anything. Just dial it in, and I'll get you in.
Perfect. Thank you so much. We look forward to joining us, and I'll take your number down, and we'll discuss stuff off air as well, man.
Thank you.
All right, later, man. Lou from Northern New Jersey, we appreciate the call tonight. This is the Metsian Podcast. We thank Till Mets Do Us Part, John Stafanaro and Matt Ibanez for calling in tonight, and we're going to go to you guys first before the final word. We want to give you one more chance at a shameless plug, and we'll start with you, Ibby.
Once again, obviously, thank you to both of you for allowing me to come on, and obviously John will attest to it as well. We really appreciate it, anything to further the reach of our own show as well. So once again, you can find me at @poison_Ibby on Twitter. You can also find us at the show handle, which is at Till Mets Do Us Part. That's located on Twitter as well as Instagram, and of course our Facebook group, Till Mets Do Us Part. That's all I got for my end. I'll throw it to my partner.
Like I said earlier, I'm at John Saponaro, Saponaro. That's on Twitter and on Instagram, so you can find me there. You can check out my website for all the other stuff I have going on, some of my hosting live appearances, like when I did the QVC. You can find on johnstapanaro.com, see where I'm going to be next. And then, as you said, follow the podcast, but also, of course, listen to our podcast, Till Mets Do Us Part. comes out every Thursday, courtesy of the Chomp Sports Network. It's on Spotify. It's on Apple. It's on Google Play. It's on whatever fly-by-night weird place people listen to their podcasts. I promise. And again, for those people suffering from the same affliction that I suffer from, if you are a Jets fan, go ahead and listen to my other podcast, which is called, very appropriately so, The Goddamn Jets, also courtesy of the Chop Sports Network. You can find us on Instagram as well, at @the_goddamn_Jets. I have a great co-host, Kimberly Cantoni, great Jets fan. She's a former Jets flight crew cheerleader. So we break it down each and every single week, and we look forward to doing it.
That's perfect, and we like to have the final word from everybody on the show. So I'm going to go to you first, John, with your final word.
My final word, get your act together, Major League Baseball. You have great fans. You have young people that would gladly invest in this sport from playing and watching. It's an exciting sport. It's better than people give it credit for, but you have to fix it, and it starts, like Mike said, from the top down. You have to make sure that you take care of minor leaguers. There's people don't play baseball because they don't want to get involved in a process that is going to take them a decade to make money when they can, you know, if they're ever good enough, they can go to the NFL and they can make money immediately. They can go to the NBA and they can make money immediately. And then from a fan's perspective, we're tired of stuff like this. Look, I understand other sports lock out. Other sports have their CBAs expire. But at the end of the day, when you're making money and the entire league, the owners, the players, everybody's making money hand over fist, when you take away the sport, the fans suffer. And baseball is in a spot right now that it is desperately trying to continue to grow and hang on to that number two spot as the most popular, second most popular sport in this country. And they need to do a better job. They need to recognize their shortcomings. They need to recognize what they do well. And dare I say it, listen to the fans and maybe inject some young blood into the office, into those offices. I'm tired of seeing guys like Joe Torre make all the decisions. I want to see some younger folks have an opportunity to shape the future of baseball. Guys like Theo Epstein, I think, deserve a job like that. And so I just want to see it. I love this sport. It's my favorite sport. It's been my favorite sport since I was 5 years old. I played it my whole life, and I don't want it to go anywhere. I want it to be here. I want to talk about Mets free agent signings and stuff going on around the league, not seven-minute closed-door meetings and stuff that happens between Tony Clark and Rob Manfred.
Couldn't have said it better myself, John. I appreciate you being on the show tonight. Thank you. And Matt Ibby Ibanez, how you doing? Thank you again for joining us. Give us your final word.
My final word? Well, I thought about talking about the lockout, but my partner had hit on every single point, which was fantastic. So everything he said, I completely agree with. But I'll keep this on the positive side, just talk about the Mets in general. Mets fans, this is a time for you to be happy, to be confident. Even though baseball is in this dark period, what we just experienced is a turning point, like John mentioned before, the LOL Mets narrative, the idea that people don't want to come here, that all ended when somebody, the ilk of Max Scherzer, signs on and comes onto this team for the next 3 years. We spoke about it with Jay Horowitz. I brought it up to him, and I mentioned how, you know, everyone always questions the idea of a player coming to New York, but you never heard that question once when it came to Max Scherzer. It's because people know what type of pedigree of player that he is. And the fact that that player is in this clubhouse now and things like that, like Billy Epler said, aren't static. It is something that breeds within a clubhouse. This is a time to be excited because finally players are in this clubhouse and players are on this team and more is to come. But the players that were signed, you should be happy because you're finally going to see players on this field that are going to put forth the effort that you as the Met fan, that blue-collar Met fan, what you want to see, that's what's going to be out there. So, once again, be happy, take it all in, and obviously there's still more to come. And obviously, again, let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets. Matt, thanks again for joining us. And again, everybody, go and like and subscribe till Mets do us part. It's a great podcast out there. Thank you both for joining us yet again. Thank you. Mike, I want to go not only to your final word, but as always, give everybody out there your shameless plug.
Oh, very quickly, Brooklyn Trolley Blogger. That's where I hang out and do stuff. Look me up. Otherwise, baseball is just rife with history. Now that there's a labor stoppage, delve into some of it. Look up, research Marvin Miller and his challenge to the reserve club. Look up Curt Flood, understand what he went through. Look up Catfish Hunter and Charlie Finley. Educate yourself on them and their machinations and what they went through. Because it has everything to do with right now, because Manfred said so. So this is a great time. Baseball, you know, in so many different ways, provides such a great history. Some for the better, some not so much. But you can't help branch out into things such as free market society, capitalism, collective bargaining. How is it that they are going to come to an agreement? Collectivism. You know, these are all things that now that we have time on our hands, jump in with both feet and understand exactly, you know, why these two sides are so entrenched in their foxholes time after time after time after time. How do you stop capitalists? We're capitalists. Do we want to be stopped? Think about that. What are we asking? And what needs to happen? So history. This is a history lesson. That's it. That's my final word, history. Baseball, once again, is providing us with history and time to delve into history, you know? Use the time wisely.
Thank you, Mike. And I'm going to go with my final word as finally. Once more, Gil Hodges is in the Hall of Fame. And Mike and I are proprietors, for my own shameless plug, on the Bedford and Sullivan podcast that keeps the audience active listeners in the research process of my own championing of a potential HBO-style TV series. And we just did a show with the baseball and barbecue folks, Jeff Cohen and Len Aberman, and we were also able to get Carl Erskine on the show to champion Gil Hodges getting into the Hall of Fame. And it's unbelievable, Mike, that we don't have to do that anymore, that type of podcast of waving our pom-poms after 70 years, it doesn't have to happen. And there are a lot of other players and a lot of other oversights when it comes to the Hall of Fame. And one of them, again, unfortunately only got half the vote tonight in John Donaldson, that Mike has also had podcasts with Peter Gordon of the Donaldson Network, trying to get John Donaldson, a great Negro leaguer who was also a Brooklyn Royal Giant, into the Hall of Fame, and unfortunately it didn't go through this time. And hopefully he gets another chance one day, and apparently it's not going to be for another 5 years at least until the next vote. But, you know, echoing history, echoing Mike's final word, at least with some, it may be bittersweet, because these are a long time coming, a lot of these elections tonight. But for us Brooklyn folk and for us Mets folk, Gil Hodges is finally in the Hall of Fame, and we can rejoice greatly in the streets of New York because of that. Thanks again to Till Mets Do Us Part, John Sapinero, Matt Ibby Ibanez. Thank you, guys. And the only way that we ever finish this show is let's go Mets. Thank you, guys. Take care, everybody. Thanks, Mike.
Good night.